Buglers, we are live from Leicester Square Theatre on the 16th of September with Chris Addison and Alice Fraser. It might be our only London date of the year, so get your tickets now. Oh, get them at thebuglepodcast.com. That bit's important.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavourless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, you know what? If you like this podcast that I appreciate you've not listened to yet, because this is right at the start, but if you listen to this and find out you do like it, then afterwards, go onto the computer or phone and search for the Lush podcast. It's the podcast where Lush, unsurprisingly, the Lush podcast, talk about the things that we think you'd be interested in hearing. So check it out. It's called the Lush podcast. And the easy way to remember that, how I remember it, is it's a podcast made by Lush. Cool. Have a listen. I might even host one time. You never know. Probably not after this audition.
Done. Welcome to Tiny Revolutions with me, Tiff Stevenson, the podcast that asks if comedy can be a force for social change. Welcome to Tiny Revolutions, and please put your hands together. I say please put your hands together. It's mainly just me clapping into a microphone. Hari Kondabolu!
Yay!
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good.
I'm eating a donut right now, which is so poorly timed on my part.
No, it's vegan donuts. They're very, very tasty. It's hard to believe they're vegan. So I feel like minus calories, right?
Yeah, right.
That's
how it works. Sometimes I'll have a donut and then I'll eat a salad because then the salad negates the calories I ate earlier.
Perfect.
Right.
You're a genius.
Uh-huh.
You should write a diet book. You need to make this happen. I think they've got one in France called the Ducan diet, and it says because 12 million French people can't be wrong, and you think that's about how many voted for the National Front. But whatever, however you want to frame it, France. So welcome to our podcast. Our podcast is all about tiny revolutions based on the George Orwell quote that each joke is a tiny revolution. So the first question I have for you, I guess, is do you believe that comedy can be a force for positive social change?
I think all art can be a force for positive social change, and I think comedy is definitely an art form, even if it doesn't always get treated as such. And it's in some ways even more impactful because of its accessibility, its directness, its ability to, you know, plays. Some people are not going to like to go to the theater. When they see stand-up, it's theater. They don't think it's theater. But that works to our benefit, right? They see somebody as accessible and as a potential friend. And because there's a promise of a laugh, they're willing to sit through the things we say, which is another reason why you better be good, especially when you're talking about sensitive topics or big political issues, because that line between rant and joke can be really slim, right?
Joke and TED Talk.
Exactly. And so, but you're promising them that laugh. And if you give them that laugh, they have no choice but to think about why they laughed. Like, why? Do I believe this? You know, I'm questioning myself. Like, it's more complicated than I thought it was, which could go the other way, too. That could also be a negative thing. Like, why did I laugh at that racist joke? What does it say about me? But, you know, I think if you're trying to create positive social change in the world, I don't think comedy doesn't work to that end. I certainly think that. I think it's dangerous when you create art to think about it actively as creating positive social change.
Right.
Because I think it affects how you write. It affects how you view yourself. I think we're egomaniacal enough to also think I'm creating positive social change while I create work is dangerous. I think the goal should always be, you know, how do I make people laugh? Am I being consistent with my voice? I'm educating myself. I'm informing myself. I find these things interesting, so I'm going to talk about them because they're interesting. If they inform people, if they lead to a positive effect, if they're passed around and inspire others, that's great. That's a positive result. But I try not to go in with that. At the bare minimum, I go in with a do no harm.
Right, like a doctor.
Yes. I think that's right, though.
Yeah,
right?
We should have a Hippocratic oath for stand-ups, right?
I mean, I feel like that is kind of always the goal. And then the frustration is like, it was just a joke. I'm just trying to make you laugh. I'm not trying to cause harm. But it's like people have such complex life experiences and journeys. And like the world is not fair, which is why comedy is great. But that's also why like comedy can be kind of, for some people, kind of icky.
I really like where you said the promise to laugh, almost like it's a contract that you've entered into with the audience. Mm. Because there is that moment, I don't think you should go in going, this is going to be a teaching moment for you all.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to teach you right now. And you go, no one's paid like $20 to go to school for the night.
That's right, that's right.
Even when it's your tour show, even when it's your solo show. And I do go in with the intention to make people think, or to maybe explode a myth about something, and sometimes to be provocative.
Sure.
I like to be provocative, and there's that great Carlin quote where they say you're a shock comic, and he says shock's just another form of surprise. All comedy is based on that.
Right.
But the idea of going in to teach people something in the first place is probably the wrong avenue. Do you approach stuff by going, when you approach a routine or a joke, I know the way that I do it. I'm interested to know what your method is. Do you see something, a social injustice or a moment or something happen, something that makes you laugh, and then respond with how you feel? Or do you write a joke first and then work from there?
I mean, I think I do both. But first of all, can I talk about the shock comment?
Okay, yeah.
I've been thinking a lot about that because I think there's some – I don't think Carlin was a shock comic. You know, I mean, I think it's does him a disservice to do that. But I do believe in the idea that – there are people who use shock for the sake of shock, as opposed to shock to bring about a greater point. Like if I shock you and there is discomfort, that discomfort gives me an opportunity to make a joke that gets you out of that discomfort. And that's where it almost feels like a magic trick.
Yes.
How did I pull this out of my head? How are you laughing at this? But, you know, I've seen enough comics where it's like the punchline's the shock and the groans and the discomfort. And that's the joke. And to me, it's like, man, I saw two planes hit the World Trade Center. What on earth is going to be more shocking than that? What are you saying to me that is so, you know, huge and, like, terrible that I'm going to be shocked by it? I can be shocked all the time by reading the news. I can be shocked constantly. What I want is I want that shock to lead to something positive, because in the real world, we never get that.
Sure.
So that was just a quick thought on that.
Yeah, no, that's a perfect way of describing it, because there are people who do a shock. You often see it with new comics. They come out and they go, what can I hit? Can I do rape? Can I be racist? Can I say something homophobic? Bang, bang, bang. And then we're in, you know, like, you know, 10 jokes down the line and you've just said the most horrific things you can think to say with no greater purpose apart from I haven't worked out how to be funny enough yet.
Right. And it's teenagers testing their limits, essentially, when you're starting to do stand-up. How far can I take this? What will happen if I do this? And when it doesn't work the way you want, you get upset. And it's like, well, yeah. Because you didn't do it well. You know, there's a lot of comics who use shock and create that discomfort and then make something magical out of it. And they put themselves in a position, they dig a hole for them to climb out of. And I think that's incredible. In terms of how I write jokes, I think it varies. You know, I think a lot of my jokes come from things that anger me, from injustice and unfairness.
Right.
From pain. Like, this hurt me, whether it's personal or something else. Like, it hurts me the world is like this. And if it starts at that point, chances are I'm going to write about it if I feel that. So sometimes it's like that. It's like, this is happening. I'm reacting to it in real time and writing it down. And there's something here. There's a punchline here. I have to build a structure around it.
Right.
Sometimes it's thinking about life experiences, which I think often, you know, it's hard to be like, I'm going to, you know, write about sexism today. I'm going to write about colonialism today. Like, it's hard to do that. But, like, you think about life experiences, and you know, that's stories are chock full of different things that are happening, right? The dynamics of a story. Like, why is this person behaving this way? Why is this person like that? What led to this and that?
It's also a micro thing that can begin with you that then becomes a macro thing.
Absolutely.
To see what it says about the world in a bigger sense. And that's how I sort of write. If it's a personal injustice or something that's happened to me, or I've noticed some sexism or an injustice, or I've even noticed my own unconscious bias creep up and kind of go, oh, that's new. What's that? Right. Where did that come from? Why am I feeling that way today? You know, and pulling that apart and kind of going out.
Right.
But I think there are some comics who start out and then maybe work in, or there are some that start out and never go in at all.
Yes. I mean, I definitely started out. And I've been trying to go more in, because in is scary.
Yeah.
It's easier to talk about an issue abstractly, intellectually, with some stake in it, but not any clarity about what that stake is. Like, you know, if I talk about like this racist thing or that racist thing and this is in the news, like that's great. And I think I've done a fair bit of that, and some of it's theoretical. But, you know, when I started talking about like depression and my family and their immigration history and stuff like that, that's actually putting myself in the story, making the issues more relatable. But it's also scarier. You know, it's just frightening. Like, oh, my God, you know who I am. Like, before, when you didn't like it, it felt like you didn't like my ideas. Now it feels like you don't like me. I mean, that's so much harder.
Yeah, it becomes very, very personal. And then you mentioned putting your family in the story, because you mentioned your mum just before we came on to record the podcast. So I'll come back to that. But is there a point where your family's fear, because my mum, I'll give you an example of when it's happened to me, and I know that this will definitely have happened to you if we touch upon the problem with the poo, but I wrote an article about being pro-choice and having an abortion when I was 17, which obviously my mum was aware of, knew about. My dad knew because I'd addressed it subsequently in a show in Edinburgh. However, it went out into The Guardian, it went to Guardian America, and I got back a lot of stuff. And then one of them, they called me a murderess, which I thought was, I took it as a quite cool, funny thing, because I was like, I won't let you have that power.
Right.
Like that when women do it, it has to have a special name.
Murderess,
and not that I'm saying that's what I did, but I was just like, it made me laugh. And then Catherine Ryan, I think, ended up putting it on some of her tour merchandise because it made her laugh. So we kind of took it back and went, we take that thing that you've thrown over here and go, no, actually. But it made my mum panic. She was like, I just don't think you should talk about this anymore. I get worried. I'm frightened for you because that's out there in the public domain. And I think you should stop talking about it for a little while. And that's the one time that she's said to me that she's been worried about something I'm saying on stage. Mm. So has that happened with your family?
Oh, yeah. Oh, especially my mother. Like, she's like, I mean, post 9/11, it was already like the atmosphere of America in terms of hate crimes and deportations and detentions, and that anger, that raw anger, like that lasted for years after 9/11. So already, like at the start of my career, there was some, like, you know, I knew I was pressing some buttons, and I'd have people yell and walk out. And, you know, I think when three years, 2007 or eight, I remember I was talking about the Islamic Community Center that was being built in New York, and they were calling it the Ground Zero Mosque, if you remember that story. And there was all that controversy, and I was talking about how it's not a mosque, it's a community center, like Jewish community center, like a YMCA or whatever. It's similar to that, and it has a religious component. I was like breaking it down, part of the setup, and somebody started screaming at me like, it is a mosque, they're terrorists. It's just the straight up, like, the caricature that I could have made up was in existence. You know what I mean?
Like, but sometimes the evidence. Someone go, if I wrote this, people would go, I don't believe that.
Exactly.
They're not real.
Right. Trump's president. Right. Yeah. Yeah. But I think that, you know, for the audience, it illustrated everything I'd been saying in the hour, because it was at the end of the show. And then he reaches out to me on Facebook and says, you think that you're going to get away with this? You don't know when you're going to see me again, and they have to increase security. And that was a decade ago. And since then, it's like, you know, I still get threats and I'll still get people trying to scare me. And I don't tell my mom most of this stuff, and she doesn't know. And it has been fine, because as long as she doesn't know, But recently, of all the things to put people over the edge, I made that documentary, The Problem with Apu, last year, which is about the cartoon character Apu from The Simpsons and what it felt like to be a South Asian kid with only one representation, and also the history of like racism and minstrelsy in America, and also, you know, an issue that I think we all talk about. What does it feel like to be a fan of someone or something? And it's more complicated because there's another aspect of them that bothers you, right?
Yes. It's like a personal disappointment,
yes,
for something that you love.
100%, which is relatable. And most people didn't see the film, which makes the criticism even more absurd, you know, like getting criticized in countries where the film has not aired. But, you know, there's been some talk about getting rid of the character, which is not what I wanted, but there's talk about getting rid of Apu. And since then, over the last month and a half, I've been getting multiple death threats a day, like from all over the world. Like, it's really, when you press the translate button on Twitter or Google or Facebook, God, it's a bummer when it's a death threat.
You don't. Is this a compliment?
Yes, exactly. And it's like, oh, no, you want to kill me. Oh, I totally did not think that. It's like, I've been learning Spanish as I've been going along, but a lot of it's from South America, which is so strange.
That's bizarre.
Yeah, somebody made a fake tweet and posted it and said that, claimed it was for me. And my tweet said something like, "You Argentinians and Peruvians, stay out of this Apu business. This is our problem." I'm like, why would I do that? Why would I go after Argentinians and Peruvians? I have no interest in this. I don't want to, why on earth would anybody do that? Why would I pick a fight with two random countries?
Yes.
And that began the whole thing.
You're not Donald Trump.
Right. I felt good that Brazil was out of it until last week. Now the Brazilians are in. Maybe the Spanish got translated to Portuguese or whatever. But, like, it's all of a sudden, it's the whole continent. I see where people are from. It's like, this is every country in South America now. They had to increase security for shows in New York before I left. And so far here, it's been fine, but it's just, I hate that. It's so stupid. And my mom, who, you know, follows me on Twitter and sees the stuff, and I tell her not to, I can't hide it from her if she sees a whole list of, you know, ways people are going to kill me, or there's tons of memes of like, hey, here's my head and Marge running it over with a car, and here's, you know, somehow like the Japanese chef like cutting my head off in The Simpsons, or like, gruesome, poorly photoshopped, I must also say, because they're never around the head. They're always like these weird squares where you can see the background of the original picture. But nonetheless, the photoshopping is secondary here. But yeah, it's just that shit is terrible. And I think it's really hard for my parents who, you know, they already had to deal with the idea of comedy is not a safe career in terms of its stability.
Right.
And it's a risk. And being an artist is a hard choice. It's a hard road, and success is fleeting. But death, who thinks death?
Yeah. Well, I was once asked, what's the biggest risk I've ever taken? I said, being a working class person in the performing arts.
That's brutal, right? Yeah, yeah.
And so it's anyone that is not this kind of dominant, mainstream, sort of straight white male voice here, public school educated, you know, that tends to be the dominant voice. And if you come for or attack that which they are associated with, people respond in ways that are, rather than taking a breath and going, maybe it's worth thinking about the possibility that there could be a problem here. And when it's done with love, because I know it's a show you love, and I remember seeing Nish talk about you talking about that, because he's a huge fan of The Simpsons.
Yeah.
And he was really annoyed when they got Lisa Simpson to address it in the show.
That killed me too, yeah.
So you made the documentary. And so then we were talking about coming, and a documentary is different to stand-up as well, you know, though the two can cross over a lot. What was the starting point for this? Was it, it's time to talk about representation, and why is this the only way that, you know, currently someone like me is being represented?
No, because it was such a, it's been 30 years, you know. So for me, it was less of a reactive, we need to talk about this now because it's so crucial at this point. It was important.
It was more for your childhood and...
Yeah, well, it was somewhat. I mean, it's funny. I first did the show, discussed the topic on W. Kamau Bell. Is a great American comic.
Yes, I love him.
He's wonderful. Very, very good. On his old TV show, Totally Biased, which I used to write for and be a correspondent on. And, you know, I was doing a thing about Mindy Kaling having a show, so this was years ago, for the first time, like her first show, and how groundbreaking that is, and going over the history of Indian representation in the U.S. And, you know, Apu came up, and I wrote some jokes about it, and that got the strongest reaction. And I initially didn't even want to do the piece because I told Kamal, like, this feels corny. Like, this has been talked about to death. This is, like, 2012. It's like, you know, who doesn't know that Apu's kind of racist? And he's like, what are you talking about? Nobody, like, your community has talked about this for 20 years, but nobody else talks about this or thinks about this. Like, this is new. So I put that up there. I do the bit. It goes online and goes somewhat viral and becomes a discussion. And then a few years later, there was some network that was looking for documentaries, and I started thinking about what would I make a documentary about. And the Apu thing seemed really interesting because there was such a discussion about representation and how that works. And Apu is a really, like, fascinating example because he wouldn't be created in the way he is today, but he's grandfathered in because it's The Simpsons.
Right.
Nobody thought The Simpsons was going to last 30 years. And all of a sudden, you have this really bizarre, stereotypical character, which to their own, they admit, like when they originally had it.
He's not a three-dimensional.
No. And they've tried to improve it since, and it's been great. But initially, like, he wasn't meant to be a regular character. He was a one-off joke, but he got so popular, they had to write for him. And so, like, to talk about something in terms of where were we back then, where this was okay, what are the impacts of this, where are we now, what, you know, can we try to figure out how we got there? Because, you know, it's like a, you know, a mosquito and nectar, right? It survived all these years still intact because it, you know, somehow it's preserved by The Simpsons. And so I just thought it would be an interesting example. And plus, of course, there was a personal stake, you know, because it had an impact on my childhood. And as someone who talks about race and representation, the time being what it is, it seemed perfect. Plus, no one's ever criticized any aspect of The Simpsons before. Which,
right,
to me as a comedian, it's like, whoa, well, that's interesting, isn't it? That's material no one's touched
because
before.
They're seen as an American family.
Right.
People view them with that level of attachment and will defend it, it would seem.
Well, it's frustrating when the comedians behave that way. When like my peers are saying stuff like that, I'm like, you fight for free speech to the death. If I criticize this cartoon, which I love as well, that's where your line is? That's where you're like, you can't do that? And then you say, I'm politically correct? How is it political correctness to go after a thing you find interesting, like just like everyone else? And, you know, I still love the show. Loving something doesn't mean that you can't critique it.
Can't be critical of it.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
That's another example why you love it so much, because you're willing to critique it. It's worth your time.
Yes, you care about it enough to be disappointed when it doesn't get it right.
Right. So for me, it was a lot of that. So it's really funny because people have said, like, oh, it took you 30 years to finally complain about this. Like, it's offensive now. I'm like, I couldn't do anything before because I was 8.
Yeah.
Like, what did you expect me to do?
I'm so sorry that I didn't release this documentary
right.
as a child. Yeah, it's kind of mad. It's kind of like, why bring it up now? This happens loads with me too.
Yeah.
Why bring it up now? It wasn't a problem back then.
It was a problem.
Yeah, it was
then,
a problem.
Yeah.
It's just now I'm able to say,
yeah,
this is a problem.
Which, it's such a frustrating thing, the privilege of not even realizing, no, we weren't allowed to talk. Or if we did speak, nobody would hear us. I mean, this is such an incredible time. And it, to me, it's like, all right, let's cover this old history. Let's nip it in the bud and we'll move on. And that's what I thought I was doing. And then we'll just move on to the next thing. And I don't think I realized that it was going to have the reaction it did, especially the angry reaction. And also, and this was foolish on my part, I just assumed people would see the film and the argument would be about the film. And then you realize.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
It has nothing to do with the film. Nobody saw the film. It was about what they think the film's about. They think it's about this idea of everything's politically correct. All our heroes have to be destroyed. We can't enjoy anything. You're destroying my child. It's like, that's not what the film. No, that is not. It's like there's a debate that happens every week about political correctness and free speech and social justice warriors. And every single week, like, something has to fill that blank. It doesn't matter what it is.
Yes.
And so I filled a blank for a while. And that's, you know, it's very frustrating because as someone who likes nuanced discussion, I thought I was creating it, and you can't.
You can't create nuance for people that don't want to hear nuance.
That's right.
For people that see stuff in black and white, you cannot bring them technicolor.
And who are not even willing to even think about the possibility. If you watch a thing and then you think about it and then you have a point, I still might disagree with you, but at least there's a shared source of information. There's like, oh, okay, we're talking about these things within these parameters and you've already covered this, so let's talk about the nitty-gritty. If you don't do the basic reading, if you don't do your homework, what are we even talking about?
I think smart people want to be proved wrong.
I think so, yeah. I think they're up for a good debate.
A smart person will want to be challenged and because otherwise, what are you holding on to?
Yes.
You know, so I think the discussion of ideas, you go, oh, I didn't think that. Okay, prove me wrong then.
Right, right.
Put to me your argument. Oh, I hadn't thought about it that way before.
Yeah.
And that at best is what I'm trying to do with stand-up.
Right,
to kind
right.
of offer that alternative viewpoint to allow someone to go, oh, I hadn't thought about it that way before. I remember once doing kind of a rowdy club gig in South London up the creek and a guy in his sort of 60s, like a real ruddy-faced, like, geezer come over and pinch my cheeks and went, I really like, I've thought about things that way before. And I'd done sort of feminism. I never say, oh, and by the way, I'm doing feminism, because I think if you have to say what it
is, exactly right.
You failed, right?
Yes.
But he really engaged with it. And I think that is at its very best, that is what comedy can do. It can take someone who'd never thought about what the problem with a poo is and make them go, oh, actually, yeah, I haven't thought. You know, I've sort of always seen that because my fiancé is Scottish. So obviously there's Groundskeeper Willie.
Yeah, yeah.
And he loves The Simpsons, you know, but you can watch that and go, come on.
Right.
So I think everyone can watch it and kind of go, oh, yeah, like though that joke there, you know, or that angle is for a show that can be so intelligent. There are points where it can be like cheap or a bit tone deaf.
Right.
For such a brilliant, you know, essentially it's a soap. I want to call it a soap.
Huh.
Because it's been around that long. And I feel people respond to The Simpsons not like it's a cartoon or not like it's a piece of satire. They respond to it almost like it's a soap. That level of investment and almost like blind thinking that I associate with people who watch, you know, where they get invested in the lives of the people.
Yeah.
And they feel like you're attacking one of their people.
Right. Which is so, I mean, I think especially with the South America stuff I've been saying, you know, I've been getting pictures, people have been sending me pictures of beef, of cows getting murdered because I'm Hindu. And so they think that will insult me because everything they know about Indians is from The Simpsons, which is my point exactly,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So, you know, to them, I'm attacked. They're like, you're never going to be funny as Apu. It's like, Apu's not real. This is a cartoon character.
Yeah.
But that to them is, they're so invested because there's nothing else. And that's what they grew up with. But the idea of me, you know, as a human being,
a
having more
person,
more in common with them than the cartoon, it's past them. And that is like kind of the point of the film. Like, this is the danger when you have limited images and those images end up coloring people's perceptions of a whole group because they just don't have the experience, the exposure. Like, you know, I grew up in New York City. Like, there is, you know, I grew up with a great deal of self-esteem in part because I had other brown people around me. It was an international city. Everyone was from everywhere. Even the white people I met, they never said they were white. Not in New York. You say you're Polish or Scottish or Irish, you know, even if you've never been there before.
Who introduces themselves as white? That's a good
question,
actually.
That's the weirdest thing. Like, I've never, like, when I went to, like, New England and the Midwest, I'd hear people say, I'm just white. I'm like, I don't know what that means.
I don't know what that's right. Like, as a white person, I don't know what that means.
What does that mean? Like, there's just a complete deletion of, like, history. I'm like, yeah, but you didn't just show up magically. Like, there was all this history and there's all these people.
And you came and took some land.
Right. And there's that, right. And all of that just completely gets, you know, wiped away. So I just find it, It's just so weird to me, all of it. Yeah.
And so the intent, obviously, was to just explore the question.
Yes.
I presume, for the documentary. And then this happens. And then how did you feel when they responded on the show?
I was bummed. I was bummed because of the nature of the response. Mm-hmm. Because, just having Lisa Simpson talk about political correctness and how things that used to be great are now seen as politically correct, what can you do? It's like, Lisa would never say that.
That was, I think, what Nish said in his thing. Yes. It made him so angry.
The ultimate social justice warrior herself, like the original. On earth would she take that stance? It wasn't her, like, the consistent
It's a betrayal
with the character.
Of the character.
It's a betrayal of the character so the producers could find a way to speak through someone else. Because Hank Azaria didn't know that was going to be in the script, apparently. He had already done his lines, and that was added right before it went out. They added a couple of scenes. So that's a producer and writer's decision. Hank had no say in the matter. And I find that really upsetting, too, because it's like, he's the one who's taking all the heat, and you put this in. Like, he's the one who has to take it. So it just feels completely,
And am I right in thinking that Hank was one of the people who said he would step down and do less characters, or he was happy to...
Yeah, which to me, like, at this point, I don't see the point of any of it. I just say, like, keep doing what you're doing. At this point, what's really the point? If you want to, within the structure of the show, make it more interesting, because they're doing the same plots over and over at this point. Like, I've seen it recently. It's like, oh, it's another Bart and Lisa detective story. I've seen these episodes. I still love it, but it's like, okay, I know this already. Having his kids talk, like having him have an adventure that takes him out of the Quickie Mart and maybe like gives him some upward mobility. Things change. I mean, they got rid of Reverend Lovejoy's wife? It was Ned Flanders' wife. They got rid of Maud. They got rid of, I think they got rid of Maud not because of like a death of the character, like the voice. They got rid of Maud because there was a salary dispute.
Right.
So it wasn't even like, so for all their talk of integrity and consistency, like that wasn't, about integrity. So there's so many interesting things to do with the character. So for me, like with Hank, what I think I took away from it is he said that the most important thing is we have to listen to South Asian Americans and Indian Americans about their experiences, their unique experiences in this country as valid and important. And really, more than anything, that's all anybody wants, just this idea that we exist and our experiences might be different, but they're part of the whole thing.
Yeah, and also, even an acknowledgement, if they went, like you say, from the beginning, they didn't know it was going to last as long when it was on Tracey Ullman's show, wasn't it?
Yes.
So they've kind of sort of shoehorned this character in. To acknowledge that would be fine, to go, we didn't really know, because some of the characters are based on real people, which I said to you before the podcast, which you were previously unaware of, that Mo is based on Rich Hall.
Which is unbelievable to me and makes so much sense now.
Yes.
His voice is, yes. Yeah.
So if you are kind of using real people as an inspiration, why could you not go back and kind of go, actually, let's flesh Apu out. Let's make him a real person with real hopes and dreams and a life, and make him 3D. I know it's a cartoon, so it's never going to be truly 3D. Yeah. But, like, why can't we do that? But I guess that's kind of asking when people feel like they're... I often think this about privilege. I think if someone has had privilege for so long, and then someone else comes along, like voices, more diverse voices. And by that, I mean diversity of race. I mean that by diversity of, gender.
Yes.
When voices are coming through that are not this kind of dominant white male thing. If I'd had privilege for that long and I feared it was going to be taken away, I would probably try and... I don't know. I'm not them. So I can't figure out why they would be as... draw this kind of line in the sand.
I mean, to me, it's interesting because I've thought about it. Is it privilege? But at this point, 30 years in, like millions and millions and millions of dollars later, like, what was once a countercultural show on Fox, which was a new network, is now like, that's the status quo. That's the longest running, most important global comedy show ever. That's incredible. Translated in languages all over the world, dubbed, like, subtitled. It's a global phenomenon. So they're set. They're now like old, rich, white men, right? So to them, there's nothing they can lose in terms of that. I think there's a fragility, though. There's a white fragility of, I've never been questioned before. This person's bringing up race. Like, this is making us look a little awkward. It was on a basic cable network, my documentary. It was 47 minutes long. The ratings weren't particularly high, and more people certainly talked about it than actually saw it. So to me, it was like, how dare you question us? How dare you make us look bad in any way? And that was the response to it.
That's an arrogance. That's a peculiar kind of arrogance, isn't it? Because I see that not just with what they do there, but what's happened with the Me Too movement recently and certain people having opportunities to address what they've done. But then some kind of arrogance in them goes, try it. See what happens.
Right.
And that's what this feels like. It's a privilege, but it's also an arrogance.
Because nothing happens to them. I mean, nothing will change. And they don't need to, you know, I mean, honestly, like I don't get why they replied, to be perfectly honest, because I made a documentary on, again, on basic cable. Like, I wasn't trying to troll them, but if I was, I won because you responded.
Yeah.
Like, why would on earth would some, you know, that means I affected
They've
you.
They've drawn more attention to your project.
Right. And unfortunately, that also means that, like, they're benefiting because it's drawing more attention to The Simpsons.
Right.
This is the most relevant they've been in years. I haven't seen The Simpsons written about anywhere until I made this documentary. Like, papers all over the world, like the controversy of some sort with this 30-year-old show. I mean, that's the best thing that could have happened for them.
I weirdly remember seeing The Simpsons quoted in newspapers in Ireland.
Huh.
Irish newspapers do a very interesting thing. They consistently quote Tommy Tiernan, who's one
of
the...
Right, yeah, of course. Right?
He's
great.
Like Jesus there. I mean, it's incredible. I've seen Tommy perform in England, but seeing him perform in Ireland is just... It's almost a transcendental experience.
Yeah.
But he is seen as almost godlike there. So he's constantly quoted, like, as Tommy Tiernan said, or occasionally, as Lisa Simpson said, as... And you're like, oh, wow. So they quote it in the newspapers there. Like, it's still, you know... So there is that, the power of being so international and worldwide known. It's a bit of a David and Goliath situation. And the fact that they can't realise who they are in that battle is a shame. And that may change. Did you regret it? No regrets.
I've thought about, like, do I regret it? Just because, like, after a while you get so worn out. And it's weird, you know, like... I didn't talk about it on stage for a long time because I hated the fact that I had a Netflix special that got released like 6 to 8 months later, and I thought the news cycle would be done and then we could focus on, you know, what I actually do. Like, that was a side project idea. This is, you know, you're a stand-up. More than anything else in your life, I'd imagine the same is true with you, Tiff.
Yeah.
Like, you're a stand-up. I do this, this, and this, but I'm a stand-up. That's what I do. And I also do podcasts and I also do film and I also... But at the end of the day, if I'm not on stage and seats aren't getting filled, then I failed, because that's what it's ultimately about. So to me, to have to talk about it even further after for 6 months more, it was hard. And I didn't want to talk about it in my act. And, you know, I've been at the Soho for the last week and I have one more week to go. And I've been talking about it finally on stage. And it's the funniest stuff in the set so far, because there's an honesty and a frustration. And it's not hypothetical, because it's this weird situation that only I am in. And it's somewhat cathartic, because I get to actually talk about how the responses that I've gotten to this thing are ridiculous, especially online. And it speaks to, like, people not wanting to have, like what we said before, a real discussion, an informed conversation. And there are moments I certainly have regretted it. And now I feel like, no, like, I can't control how people view the work I've done. And all I can do is create the next thing.
Yes. You can only control your aspect of it. And that's such a nice way of looking at it.
Yeah.
You can control that. You can't control how it's received.
No.
And we can't withstand up either. And then sometimes something like this comes along and reminds you that that's the case. And I did a video for The Economist recently, and it was about where we are a year on from Me Too.
Right.
And I had men's rights activists come from it. I had threats, I had death threats, I had, you know, you should have your clitoris cut off. It became, and it was such a, like, this woman clearly hates men. And I'm like, this is so ridiculous to me, because I'm invested in men. I've got shares in Woke Bros. I'm fully invested. I'm engaged. I have a fiance. I have a stepson. I love men. And it's really important that we can all learn, that we all talk about consent, and that we all have a really engaged and important conversation on both sides. But, you know, and that was part of my problem with the Me Too discussion. I felt like it lacked such nuance when we make Louis C.K. the same as Aziz Ansari or the same as Bill Cosby. And then we're talking about them all as if they're the same, when actually they're all quite different, and there's a lot of nuance, and there's a lot of grey area, and there's a lot to be discussed about consent on both sides, and lots of learning to be had. I guess when we reduce stuff to hashtags, it's a problem as well. But you have to have the kind of shortness or quickness for some kind of movement to take fire.
I mean, that's the thing. Like, movements don't always work with nuance, right? Because when you're just trying to be heard, nuance ends up slowing you down in a weird way, right? When you're pushing forward. And then you try to sort out the nuance later. But so I kind of get, like, you know, when you're initially you're angry, and then it takes a while to, like, slow down. Let's actually see it. But, like, you know, after so many years, you know, to finally be able to speak like this, I can imagine there's a ton of, like, let's get this all out now.
And, that's why I totally get the anger and the frustration. And I've been in situations, and I've had feelings, and I've, you know, what happened last year was very triggering for a lot of women, I think, because we all went through our experiences of what had happened to us. And then you start to get to a point where you go, there's actually too many for me to list that go from minor, small events to big, catastrophic, awful, impactful, life-changing events. You know, they run the gamut from that, from a bit of everyday sexism, you know, to this person is a rape survivor, or, you know, this woman died. As well, it actually made me think of the civil rights movement there. I just sort of had a moment of thinking about Martin Luther King versus Malcolm X, how you choose to move forward with your protest and drive social change, and their opposing views, that one person believed that non-violence and love was the answer, and the other person said any means necessary to achieve your ends.
And they work, and they're intertwined, right? Yeah. Like, and definitely towards the end of King's life, he was definitely getting closer, some small steps towards the Malcolm X stance. And by the end of Malcolm X's life, you know, after he'd gone to Mecca, he had seen it much differently. And I think his journey through Islam made him a much more connected person in terms of, like, we're all God's children, so how do we make this work? So, but I think you need that, like, fire and ice, right? You need the give and take.
Sure. Yeah. I think I read quite a lot of Maya Angelou when I was at school, and that was one of the interesting things that I noticed, because she knew Malcolm and she knew Martin Luther King as well. Yeah. And she was always about forgiveness. She was always about forgiving the person that has hurt you, that has attacked you, that has taken something from you. And I found that really interesting. But I also see the other side of the argument. I remember doing a podcast just after the Harvey Weinstein stuff broke. I think it was Guilty Feminist. And we were talking about how Harvey Weinstein had been described as this kind of, like, fat pig by someone. That was the description they'd used. And Deborah said, I don't think it's okay to do that. And I said, I think it's okay for the victim of a crime to describe their attacker or the perpetrator in any kind of terms they want,
right,
until they decide they don't want to, you know, like that. She was kind of like, I don't like the idea of us calling him ugly or fat or unattractive. And I was like, I think it's within the rights of the person that that's happened to be able to say that. I don't think there's a moment of them going, you know, if you wanted to say he was repulsive, because someone who's attacking you and raping you would be repulsive to you. You know, so there was an interesting sort of point there of that was about expelling anger and being very real and visceral. And then I hear sometimes with movements, like, why should we control our anger? We're done with being nice, you know, with something like the Black Lives Matter movement. And I understand that as well, of people going, no, we're done being nice.
Right.
We've tried to do it this way and it's just not working anymore.
Especially depending,
we're going to be angry.
And also because of how egregious it is, just like the killing of unarmed black men and women, like, you know, like, I don't want to, like, can we just stop that? It's like, it's a very clear request also. I was thinking about, the conversation we were having a little while back, and you asked me, like, do I regret doing the documentary and all that? And at the end of the day, I don't, because I know I'm right. Like, I know I'm right. Like, I know at the end of the day, when people have heard of The Simpsons and don't watch it with the same, like, ferocity, because everything at some point loses, you know what I mean? Like, everything loses steam at some point. And life moves on, and there's new art and more nuanced stuff gets made. I know that people will be like, oh, he was right. Yeah, that's right. I don't understand why that was an issue. Why were they debating that? How come there was a fight over that? Like, This is a very obvious point. And I feel like that's just inevitable. I truly believe that's inevitable. So it's just a matter of, like, I'll take this now, but I'm not going to look bad in about 10 years, I think, if not even sooner than that, probably.
That's good. There's a legacy, isn't there? There's something that comes after in the immediate when it dies down and we look back and we go, actually, there was one person that stood up and said, here's what the problem with this is.
Right. And also, like, well, that was a really simple point. Why is everyone yelling at him? He was just saying a very obvious thing that we all agree with right now.
Well, here's, interestingly, where we come back to what the kind of point of the podcast is, I guess, is about can comedy be a force for social change? Because your documentary and your stand-up are being used in high school at the moment and being shown to people. So that your work has made a difference there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, every time I hear about it, the documentary or my stand-up being shown in high schools or colleges or grad schools, it's always a shock. Like, it also, but there's a part of me that's like, this is how we should be spending our classroom time. There is that part of me that's like, is this really going to be effective? But then I hear the stories of, like, kids writing papers and being able to understand that because, you know, stand-up's great strength is taking complex things and making them more digestible. Sometimes you lose complexity, but you hope stand-up keeps enough of the complexity where people, like, really understand something for the first time. It's a great 101. And so the idea that, like, it's been able to do that is again, not the intention. Like we talked about earlier, I just this is what bothers me and this is what I'm trying to deal with and get through. And this is my defense mechanism and art form. And it's amazing that it's able to do other things
too. Your art's being taught in school.
Yeah.
I love that. Yeah. And also, I believe great stand-up, and your stand-up is great, is like philosophy.
Yes.
So you can use it to explain all these philosophical principles and ideas. And there's a lot of moral relativism in it as well. And that, I think, that's why it's a really useful tool for people to look and understand nuance. Thank you for coming on the podcast. You have been incredible. You're the perfect guest for the podcast.
It's so nice to be on. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Also from Lush Podcast, the John Robb tapes. Punk legend John Robb digs through his cassette tapes to bring you exclusive interviews with other musical icons. Some are from the vault and some are brand spanking new. Find the John Robb tapes wherever you find podcasts and on the Lush Player.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.